hate me because my culture is superior to yours, but mainly because the Uteruk had declined to attend due to an argument with the Trillion Kingdoms of Yuz over whether or not any silicate portions of the stone Uteruk anatomy that crumbled away should be swept up and tossed out, or had inalienable citizenship rights among the intelligent sand dunes of the Yuz, and therefore forfeited their place. When Flus took the stage, all fell silent. The various committees had done everything they could to make him feel comfortable, friendly toward his new neighbors, secure and well-liked. They could do nothing more to help. He had no costume. He had no set. He had no fire effects or lighting displays or gravity projections. These things were unnecessary when you were a 2-ton dagger-tailed illustration of the concept of solipsism. He hated all this glitter and fuss and lurid, flashy, terribly suspect stuff. All you needed to be truly entertained was yourself. A military uniform with clean, masculine lines, an unwavering loyalty to the collective, and the suffering of anyone not yourself. He had seen no point in a band name, as all was Flus, and Flus was all, and everyone here would be Flus as well, momentarily, once he could get a bead on how their weapon systems worked. But when pressed by the Keshet and Ilunazar judges, begrudgingly wrote down Flus-Loose on the form. Flus stood center stage, the footlights glinting on his blade body, and proceeded to atonally scream-sing by grinding the knives of his face together. It is awesome to be Flus. If you are not Flus, you are not awesome, and will promptly be consumed. Also your children and pets. Go, Flus, go. Flus the world. Flus it so hard. Then go back and Flus it again. Back up over it, put it in gear, hit the gas, once more with the Flus, go Flus yourself, no, but actually. It was the only song he knew. The best song, the song of himself. Flus had written it, composed it, sung all the vocals, played lead face on the track, produced it, mastered it, and designed the album art all by his billions of selves. It had gone infinite platinum, twice. What could ever be better than Flus? A bunch of sand in the shape of a heart? Yeah, right. Why were they not clapping? Why were they looking so bloody damn sad? Why were they so obstinately not Flus? Flus was still asking himself this when the first Ilunazar gunships descended into low orbit around Muntin, and their shadows darkened the seas. 20. Love in Rewind. Wait! The voice of Decibel Jones echoed down the fluorescent black coral hallway, disturbing the chartreuse cilia wherever it bounced. Wait! E! Little buddy! That's probably racist. I'm sorry. Sir. Sir E. Wait! Good God, you're a quick little rotter. Shit, sorry again. The time-traveling red panda paused in his epic battle with staying on his own four legs and not spending his entire life ass over tea kettle, and peered up, deeply annoyed, into the Englishman's eyes. Those eyes, as black as stout and the Styx, were almost as vulnerable and needy and yearning as any Esker's. What? You Keshet. You travel in time, yeah? That's what the bird said. You know, that's very rude. Rude and just weird. That's like me saying, you humans, you reproduce with a uterus, yeah? And you'd say, yes, I suppose, but hell, E, when you say it like that, it just sounds gross. Right, sorry again. But you do. Yes, for God's sake. And you see every timeline, all laid out like taxes, every single way, every single everything could ever or would ever go. This is pornographic, Mr. Jones. And you went rummaging through timelines on Earth and whatnot. You had to get Walter over there in the engine room with his leg over, yeah? Please stop. I have to go. I... I left the Industrial Revolution running.
Decibel Jones, glitterpunk saint, sinner and siren, stared down at the plush red creature, wringing his tail between his hands in abject embarrassment.
I was only wondering.
Can you tell me where I went wrong?
Please. Everything was so good. Everything was like Elmer finally catching bugs, and it was like that over and over for months and years. And then it wasn't. I had something, and then all of a sudden I couldn't ever, ever get it back. But it's like I couldn't tell the difference between the day before it all got its face bashed in and the day after. When did I fuck it up? Was it that night? Should I have said yes? Should I have kissed her until she stopped crying and then ordered room service? What should I have done different? There had to be a moment when I could have kept it all together. But I didn't. I didn't.
Infinite timelines and possibilities unfolded in the eyes of the Keshet, like points on a map of the galaxy. Grids and branches and forks and veins of mathematical destiny, flashing away into the dark like spent sparklers on a deep summer night in someone else's childhood. E patted Decibel's knee.
What if you did?
Fire. You know I will rise like a phoenix, but you're my flame.
Rise like a phoenix, Conchita Wurst.
21. Hello from Mars.
Letost is a neutral planet in the dragonfly-colored dust cloud formation we call the Pillars of Creation, and everyone else calls a bit of an unsightly mess. Almost 7,000 light-years from Earth, and almost 7.5 light-years from its nearest, drunken, hostile, politically conservative neighbor. This was a lucky thing for Letost, considering the dominant species that lived there, the previous year's winner of the Metagalactic Grand Prix, the Claveret. Letost is the kind of world a child would design, if that child had never been harmed by the world in even the smallest way, and wanted to be a rainbow when it grew up, and only ever read books about unicorns, wildflowers, and everything working out very nicely, not only in the end, but in the beginning. And the middle, too. It has two small white suns, three pink moons, several lavender oceans with the same sugar content as Earth's oceans have salt, a single huge continent full of rich green antidepressant grasses watered by refreshing diamond showers, healing rivers, and forests where no one can ever get too lost on account of the nightlight lichen. While this continent is home to a number of gentle variations on the basic bear, cow, fish, bird playset living in peaceful symbiotic harmony, Letost's crowning evolutionary achievement is the Claveret, a species of large, intellectually gifted patches of seafaring pastel flowers, something of a three-way hybrid of roses, tulips, and doilies. They have all the natural defenses of a pillow in a tiger enclosure. At least twice, the planet escaped being overrun by the aforementioned neighbors after the invaders grew exhausted with having to explain, slowly, patiently, and using large friendly diagrams, charts, and illustrations, the concept of war to a field of flowers, giving up halfway through a run of supplementary comic books starring Sebastian, the conflict marshmallow. The Yurtmak call Letost proof that God hates us and wants us to suffer. The existence of the Claveret was discovered by the Vorpret just after the species on the other side of the new wormhole decided turnabout was fair play, followed the rude parade of colonial ships crashing their sector of space, and started pouring through to points unknown. The parasitic viral life forms picked up the radio waves from a telenovela that was wildly popular on Letost in those days. Everyone gets enough love. The most famous Claveret rock group of all time, Sons and Roses, won the 4th Metagalactic Grand Prix on the homeworld of the Alunazar, who dominated the Grand Prix in the early years, much to the annoyance of everyone else. In fact, that winning streak combined with their overwhelmingly cultural and military hegemony, proved so irritating to the rest of the galaxy that it has become something of a beloved tradition to vote them down into the lower ranks every single year until they cry. The Claveret won resoundingly that year, singing in their traditional method, vibrating their stamens at the precise frequency of empathy, allowing the audience to hear one another's favorite childhood lullabies, thousands upon thousands of them, at which point Sons and Roses broke down, mashed up, and remixed that noise into a truly sick beat. Last year, they finally managed to snatch the crown again, with their dance craze, "Let's talk about our feelings so no one has to hurt inside." It would have been a unanimous verdict, except for the Yurtmak, who vomited on their ballot and then put it in the box with a huge, razor-toothed grin. Litost is also home to what was once an unassuming market town of no particular strategic or cultural importance called Vlemu, where the final battle screamed itself mute and the war finally ended. Vlemu rests on the tip of a heart-shaped peninsula, kissed by the carbonated lilac ocean of unconditional acceptance. It looks like anywhere else. It has no memorials, no statues, no museums or weekend historical reenactments to commemorate the final annihilation of the old world and the painful, strangling, blue-faced birth of the new one. But it does have a fantastic concert venue. The Cake in the Rain made planetfall in the seas just offshore the brand new, paid nearly in full, we promise, Colosseum the Claveret built for this year's Grand Prix, and named the Stage of Life. Massive slabs of chamomile crystalline herbstone, the color of watermelon-flavored smoke, formed a state-of-the-art rock arena, approximately the size of the Isle of Man, crowded with towering subwoofer topiaries, shaded by hypno-kelp lighting rigs, mined with hidden gouts and hoses for fire, water, and vaporized hallucinogen effects, gravity geysers, weather sinks in case a song required a Pelulian winter to really pop, holographic floats, and an army of tough, proud stamen mics ready to take a beating and without so much as a whimper of feedback. The first two human beings to set foot on another world stepped out of the jelly hatch and into the warm, ever so slightly joy-colored light of Litost's twin sons, which the Claveret refer to collectively as our mums. The second their feet touch the talcum sand of the alien beach, not actually silicate, but a very pleasant strain of powdered MDMA, a searing bolt of laser fire sliced through the ground in front of them and the top of Decibel Jones's left shoe, scorching both as black as bad feelings. A little lacy giggle vibrated through the fresh sea air. Up the strand, a large patch of pastel flowers, twisted up into a topiary with a 74-caliber Uterac pumice pistol tangled in its vines. The Claveret maiden waggled a few briars at them and called out in a cheerful, bubbly soprano voice, "Sorry, I'm just ever so clumsy." Behind her, a large striped camera bobbed and darted in the air, disappearing and reappearing as rapidly as any paparazzi flash bomb. Ought Saint Ultraviolet, well-respected man about town, was almost completely certain that camera had a tail. "Pure butterfly fingers, that's me," trilled the sentient rosebush. "See you on stage." "That fucking shrubbery just tried to kill us," shouted Decibel Jones. "That can't be allowed." The lovely Esker stepped lightly down the gangplank of her ship and stretched in the sunlight, which turned her feathers into the colors of Earth's sky. She put her wings round the band member who once sold jars of their breath at the merch table and enthused, "Allowed? Oh, we encourage it. Rule 20, darlings. Welcome to the Grand Prix." 22. Tell her I send my regards. The 30th Metagalactic Grand Prix was held on Atoge, a gravitationally down-for-anything mirror ball of a world just close enough to the supermassive black hole at the center of the galaxy to make popping down to the event horizon for a carton of relativity a snap, without having to constantly worry about whether your front garden is about to become one with the singularity. It was the year everything changed. This flashy hotspot with commanding views of the mind-jellying infinite raw reality beyond the accretion disk is homeworld to the Uteric, a race of, to get it out of the way quickly, blinged-out Easter Island statues with faces like busted Kachina dolls, bodies like rejected Stonehenge designs, and a sense of humour like a rock dropped down a dry well. They live a little longer than a human, stand a little taller than a human, and could brutally pulverize a human by accidentally brushing against the shoulder of one on the tube platform. A Toge is the most absurdly, flamboyantly, unrealistically mineral-rich planet a geologist could write down in her dream journal. Its seas are liquid gold and platinum. Its mountains, so stuffed with gemstones that volcanic eruptions are anticipated by tourists like piñatas at a billionaire's birthday party. And any random bucket of dirt would keep a human tech manufacturer in rare earths for a decade. Over the millennia, everyone and their overbearing mother has tried to invade and loot the Uteric's ridiculous dragon horde of a world. So, unsurprisingly, they are a rather defensive, anxious, socially awkward people who have elevated military strategy well beyond art, philosophy, or science, and well into an autonomic bodily process. An Uteric is physiologically incapable of sitting down to breakfast without making sure he has his bacon at a decisive disadvantage and his children arranged around him in a classic tortoise formation. However, since they really did have such an obnoxious run of surprise gold rushers to beat off, almost all of that vigorous Uteric strategic metabolism is devoted to defensive action. They just never got a chance to get out there, sow their war oats, and get down to thrashing anyone else. They were too busy trying to keep their neighbors from stealing their ocean. Until the sentience wars, that is. At which point, the Uteric discovered that, while going on the offensive was just about as much fun as you could have with a standard-issue dark matter rifle, and certainly added vast quantities of treasured memories to their strategic scrapbooks, you felt really awful afterward. The rush was nothing like defeating a species of invasive horror snails who thought they could nick your nickel while you were doing the shopping. Somehow, when you attacked first, you were left with the distinct and uncomfortable sense that you might be a bad person. Over the enraged indignation of their allies, Igneous Lagom Opt, the grand volcanic commander of the unified forces of the Uteric Formation, took her base and went home after 4 months. For this, she received every honor the unified forces could bestow. A few new ones they'd had lying about, waiting for a special occasion, and when no one could think of anything else but still felt too grateful to quit while they were ahead, threw the Alluvial Prize for Chemistry, the Golden Stalactite for Best Actress in a Dramatic Performance, and the Dull Chisel Award for First Novel at her as well. Everyone felt a great deal more relaxed, pottering about at home with the spring cleaning, fortifying their local star systems, priming orbital defense platforms, and suction mining the gravity well of their beloved supermassive black hole than they ever had done using Vorpret ships for target practice. Of course, none of the other powers were about to let the heavy lifters clock off early. The Urshlers tried to crop dust a Toge with various hypnotic gases to make the Uteric more willing to listen to reason, first attempt, aggressively belligerent in their own right, second attempt, or immune to regret and or other inconvenient moral considerations, 11th and final attempt. The only lasting result of all this emotional vaporware was the invention of psychotherapy among the Uteric. While the galaxy burned itself stupid all around them, the mental health arts experienced their renaissance, enlightenment, industrial revolution, and technological singularity all rolled into one extremely comfortable couch in the wilds of a Toge. The capital city, Stratum Talaka, remains a psychiatric boomtown to this day. As the saying goes, if you can listen there, you can listen anywhere. The Uteruk won the 9th Grand Prix with an industrial trip-hop sea shanty called You Bombarded My Heart with Overwhelming Air Superiority, as sung by the deliriously handsome boy band Wind Condition Alpha, with a surprise cameo on backup vocals, none other than the famous Igneous Lagom Opt. Second place went to the machine intelligences known as the 321 for their precision-tuned 89-minute neo-gangster math-rock anthem, This Program Has Encountered an Error and Must Shut Down. Coded, compiled, and submitted by the entity known as Monad. Presumably, the plan to rig the 30th Grand Prix was set in motion shortly after Opt and Monad met at the after-party. Retirement bored the Grand Volcanic Commander nearly to dust, and the entity known as Monad found it profoundly illogical that the 321 had never won the Grand Prix, despite mathematically determining the perfect song every single year. The scheme would not find its feet, however, until the third member of their conspiracy appeared on the scene. Orcafall Avatar Zero, hardcore, trash-folk, acid-scar crooner of the Lumatis, a new species discovered by a sieve algae cloud that had drifted off its shipping lane. Unlike that of the Yurtmak, or indeed of humanity itself, the sentience of the Lumatis was never in doubt, and they'd been welcomed into the galactic family with no conditions attached, bypassing all the upsetting drama that Decibel Jones and the Absolute Zeros are currently heir to. They were the biological equivalent of the girl in school who everyone wanted to hate because she had it all. Looks, smarts, athletic abilities, a stable home life, all the latest fashions. But no one could, because she was just so fundamentally bloody nice. And anyway, all she wanted to do with her natural advantages was sit in the corner and draw pictures of unicorns. No one knew what a Lumity actually looked like. On their Grand Prix entry forms, under Kingdom, Phylum, Class, Order, and so on, you know the drill, they put, decline to state. In the years after their discovery, the most popular after-dinner party game involved retiring to the library with brandy and cigars and a new theory on the taxonomical classification of the Lumatis. The only facts they had ever confirmed about themselves were that they lived under the surface of their planet, had no desire to leave, but were perfectly prepared to prevent others from landing if the need arose, reproduced via parthenogenesis, and were not, in fact, larger than a bread box. As a culture, they had long ago packed up the sorts of internecine conflicts, plagues, economic booms and busts, and privations that fueled the history of most planets, and devoted themselves entirely to visual art and technology. But only as far as technology allowed them to improve their art. The Lumatis never travelled anywhere, nor has anyone else dared to make planetfall. Nevertheless, there's no such thing as a good party without one. The only part of a Lumity you can actually get your hands on is a small, extremely shiny metallic object, about the size, weight, and colour of a guava. Flat on one side, rounded on the other, entirely giving the impression of a novelty paperweight. It is not a paperweight. Each of these can project a three-dimensional, hyper-realistic, interactive virtual avatar of a Lumity, anywhere within a kilometer or so of itself. It was this handy gadget that allowed the Esker to project itself all over the place on the day of their quiet invasion. Branding them as rebooted pet rocks had been the Keshet stroke of marketing genius, and the Lumatis graciously loaned their tech to the cause. These avatars are utterly unique, astonishingly inventive, gorgeous as all get-out. Orcafall Avatar Zero appeared on the occasion of the 30th Metagalactic Grand Prix as a kind of furry spoonbill stork, with long, soft puppy ears, three eyes, a tail like a bridal train, and all the colours of a Mardi Gras that had finally stopped holding back. The Lumitus had spent approximately half a second back in their Stone Age making icons that looked like realistic versions of themselves and sped right through to Fantasyland. Upon first contact with the Sieve, they asked only that their planet remain undisturbed and that the perplexed magenta algae mind fill a cargo hold with Lumo stones and carry them anywhere they thought was a bit lively. Everyone who was anyone decided they had to have one if they were to live and breathe another day. And soon enough, the Lumitus had quietly spread to every civilized world, not to colonize or spy or even see the sights, but simply to run up their score. The Lumitus are, at all times and without exception, logged in to the most massively multiplayer game in the history of the galaxy. They keep the rules to themselves, so as not to end up suffering the humiliation of foreigners and newbies topping the leaderboards. But occasionally, at some particularly passionate turn in the conversation, display of skill, especially clever pun, romantic entanglement, or bar fight, a Lumity avatar will grin and say, 50 points, 100 points, 1,000 points plus optional power-up. They got a massive bonus if they could convince someone to carry their Lumo stone to a new location. But beyond that, they kept mum. As they hadn't had a war in 1,000 years, never even bothered to land on their own moon, and points in a game no one else played were their only concern and ambition, the Lumitus were determined to be real stand-up fellows and no threat to anyone. In retrospect, it was inevitable. The distribution of galactic resources was too important. They'd been terrifically lucky. Everyone agreed to let a bit of pop music decide their share this long. Eventually, someone would have tried to fix the game in their own favor. It just so happened to be Igneous Lagom Opt, Monad, and Orcafall Avatar Zero who got around to it first. It was a ridiculously simple plan. If the whole socio-political economic apparatus of the known galaxy was determined by Grand Prix ranking, then, obviously, if someone didn't show, everyone else moved up a notch. Atoge had been paying in more minerals than it got out in agricultural timeshares for years, and the 3-2-1 were sick and tired of fixing everyone's computers just because they were raw computer code themselves. This was, if you looked at it a certain way, an issue of planetary defense. Orcafall just wanted the points. Since no one was expecting anything but a weekend of glitter rock debauchery, the entity known as Monad powered down the privacy walls, and Igneous Lagom Opt and Orcafall Avatar Zero walked right into the Sieve Lagoon, where the supergroup, us, was getting its beauty sleep. They decanted the gooey pink algae into a couple of spent liquor bottles, corked them, and stuck the lot in Opt's basement until the Grand Prix was over. The Lumitus came in 51st out of 52, with Orcafall belting out first-person suitor to the cheap seats. Technically, the Sieve came in last since they hadn't sung a note, though they appealed the decision immediately. More than a century later, reparations are still tied up in court, which is unsurprising, given that Gogonar Gorkanon's fifth general unkillable fact is carved in fiery letters over the forbidding door to the galaxy's maximum overcourt on Sagrada. Justice takes so long that by the time you get it, it's gone off and smells like an old corpse. Forget about justice, just knock back a big stiff drink and move to a new town with fewer pronks living in it. When the whole plot was uncovered due to the entity known as Monad bragging to the Stratum Talaka municipal mainframe about it, and very shortly afterward, the Sieve breaking out of the basement in a wave of fuchsia fury and bringing down all the wrath of the Grand Prix Oversight Committee upon them, the conspirators merely shrugged and said, "Well, you know, we might have killed them. Don't know what you're so cross about. They can go without carbon for a year. Don't make such a fuss." A light bulb went on in many, many heads at once. The 31st Metagalactic Grand Prix descended into an utter greased pig clown show, as every Yuz, Yurtmak, and Alunazar tried to ice out their competition before the doors even opened, causing a constitutional crisis on the administrative board of the Grand Prix, two riots, several stern meetings, and a wormhole blockade that lasted for the better part of 3 weeks, crippling the economy of 6 commercial bank worlds. It was barbaric, they said. It was immoral. It was against the whole spirit of the thing, the whole idea of sentience. In those days, plenty of old soldiers were still listening in the stands, who remembered when being locked in basements had nothing to do with music. It had to be stopped. But then the Keshet launched their holistic live total timeline broadcast. This involved a special camera, still classified as a state secret, with a disturbing, semi-legal amount of Keshet stem cells suspended in a shiny neoplast gel matrix, so that this low-level techno-biological abomination could travel through all possible timelines as easily as any bouncing red space panda. Suddenly, the galactic audience could gorge themselves on unlimited metagalactic coverage in quantum real-time. They could witness every botched kidnapping, dodged assassination, bungled poisoning, and missed interdimensional tripwire from the comfort of their own recreation zones, and they loved every minute of it. Finally, the oversight committee gave up, sequestered the barbaric, immoral, vaguely unsentient, but massively popular shenanigans into a new semi-final round, and formally instated Rule 20. If a performer fails to show up on the night, they shall be automatically disqualified, ranked last, and their share of communal galactic resources forfeited for the year. The Grand Prix was never the same again. Before, you could only do your best. After, there was strategy. Igneous Lagom Opt died a happy rock, and really hardly anyone has actually died. Decanted, locked in a maze, semi-permanently muted, phased into a pocket universe, frozen under several glaciers. Yes, but everyone tries to keep things light-hearted if they can, and simply shooting someone in the face will never pull in the kind of viewership a good causality blast can bring. After the trial, Orcafall Avatar Zero was, by a series of even less likely events, elected Prime Minister of Letost, despite rather obviously not being a Klavar, or even plant-based. At his swearing-in ceremony, he reprised his Grand Prix performance, took a deep bow, and began to sparkle from beak to foot. He looked into the adoring faces of his people and said, "Level up." 23. In the Waiting Room for Great Luck. The Klavaret are known throughout the galaxy as wonderfully gracious hosts, but they have always had trouble with the idea of architecture. Being a heliophiliac species, they have simply never seen any reason to build shelters that might keep sun or rain from sufficiently nourishing them. This is the reason Decibel Jones and the Absolute Zeros found themselves in what could only very generously be called a room, having no roof, no floor, and several objects that looked as though someone had heard about the idea of walls from some foreign traveller who thought they were some kind of modern dance. There were about 50 of them, all quite unnecessarily tall, interleaved frosted glass slabs of varying oval, diamond, crescent, helix, and bubble shapes, none of which joined up to make anything so limiting as a corner, but rather stayed in constant motion a few centimeters off the ground, rotating round so that, if you ignored them, you might almost think you were slightly indoors. It was like standing inside a very fancy blender. "Sing to it," the Roadrunner coaxed. "Go on." Decibel Jones frowned and put his head to one side. "That is a portable toilet," he said. Indeed, the only other object in the Klavaret's valiant effort at a green room was a large seafoam green rectangular booth with a peaked roof and silver hinges on the front. To be perfectly fair, it was a lovely porta potty, extremely tidy and made out of some material that looked rather like wet oil paint. Despite being several times harder than the Leetosian diamonds that filled the spring clouds above them.
No, it's the last nice thing I can do for you before the semi-finals, babies,
sighed the Eska. She shut her gentle, enormous eyes as though she were just then experiencing her culture's first headache. She'd explained the semi-finals over and over to them, at least the part she was allowed to tell them about. But they didn't seem to be absorbing it.
Do we need weapons?
Decibel said, softly.
It's sort of more of an improv thing, the Roadrunner admitted. I would just focus on defense. Humans have no special physical attributes whatsoever. It's really quite remarkable. They'll go right for you since you're brand new. The armor will help.
Ort Ultraviolet squinted at the green booth. It's definitely a toilet. We've played a lot of festivals, so I know what I'm about, Birdie.
I can't let you compete looking like that. It would be humiliating for you, for your planet, for the Eska as your chaperone.
Des knew he should probably keep his mouth shut, but he hadn't flown across the galaxy in an honest-to-Christ Alexander McQueen to have his aesthetic insulted by a flamingo.
What do you mean, looking like that? This is vintage.
Sure, my hair's not really earning its wage at the moment, but come on. Why can't you take anything seriously, Des? Ort complained. He hadn't slept the night before. His bones ached. He could never get warm when he hadn't slept. Decibel stared at his bandmate.
It's my job.
It's my only job, never to take things seriously. Your job is to take everything seriously. If I started, you'd have to stop, and the actual universe would actually collapse.
I'm sorry, have we met?
Decibel stuck his hand out, too aggressively. Ort flinched. He rolled on anyway.
My name's Danny. What's yours?
Ort gave him a disgusted look and turned his back to examine the green box. There's a picture of a little man on the side with stuff coming out of him, he informed everyone.
No, it's a late model Yuzosh Autobotanical Frockade. Just one of these costs the gross domestic product of a mid-size mining colony. The Trillion Kingdoms of Yuz donated them to the Grand Prix because they are generous and have a real sense of stagecraft and fair play, and it was a tax write-off.
It smells like bleach and puberty, Des mused.
Base elements can't help what they smell like. Would you just sing to the nice machine? That's how you're paying for it. The only currency within the bounds of the Grand Prix is music. Sing for your supper. Sing for your breakfast. Sing for your bar tab. Sing for the clothes on your back. So get out your wallets or you're going to miss the starting bell.
We're not ready. Decibel whispered, gone completely pale. Dark circles of exhaustion ringed his eyes like overdone raccoon liner.
We haven't finished the song yet, not even a little finished, not even almost.
The Roadrunner hooted in frustration.
Don't worry about that yet. Does that look like a stage?
No. You're going to step inside, strip off, hold out your arms, get hosed down with one of the great useful goops of the universe. A nice, lightly clairvoyant mist of accelerated spores, microbulbs, empathic molds, local rainwater, and a combination of highly efficient fertilizers. Then you'll pop out the other side, dressed to the nines and armored to the gills, have a couple of drinks, and then turn in early with a nice cup of milk, knowing you.
Jones crossed his arms skeptically over his chest.
But why?
The Eska had had enough. Ort had told her not to, but not using her voice to its full potential was just too much work. Mira's voice poured warmly out of the tall blue anglerfish flamingo mashup.
This is part of it, boys. We need to see who you are. You can't fool the frockade. You can't lie to spores. The useful goop of the Yuzosh is going to soak into you, learn as much as it can, and rearrange itself into a fetching outfit that will advertise your inner self like a giant neon sign. It's going to put your insides on the outside, spiritually speaking. The Yuz originally used it as an interrogation device, then a dating aid. Once, an Anvari went in and came out dressed in a tuxedo of screaming faces on fire. Very good for us to know what he was made of, you see? Ah, I know how to explain. Recall the scene in the hit film of summer 1984, Splash, in which Eugene Levy surprises Daryl Hannah on the New York City street and sprays her down with a hose, which reveals her true mermaid nature for all to see. It is that. That is going to happen to you. Your tail will flap very wetly on the concrete, and people will take many pictures of your most secret and intimate self. Not bad, right?
You're gonna pump us full of more toxic rot, you mean?
I don't even do dairy, Ort protested.
I take antibacterial gel with me if I'm going down to the shop for crisps. Gotta keep the girl's hands clean and all.
The Roadrunner whirled round. Her face flashed instantly from Mira's to the creaky leather and disapproval voice of Ort's father.
Uma chick, how many times shall I have to tell you there is no good thing to be had in killing you before the show? Do you know how many species are mucking about down on this town? All possessing of different dietary needs and allergies and stress tolerances? 57. To keep halal is nothing to compare. And we've not had so much as a batch of bad fish in 200 dinner rushes of this nature. We have got this sorted, my son. We have got this dialed in. Don't go swim for an hour after. Don't pick at it. And it rinses right clean in 6-7 hours, Yvette. Is perfectly safe. Sometimes I worry about my boy. No one else has ever made such a problem for me. Look, will it make you feel cozy if I go first?
No, grumbled Ort.
Absolutely, said Decibel Jones.
And what's going to happen to our togs?
The Roadrunner was in full orchestral mode now. She puffed her feathers and shifted hard from Mr. Omar Jalishkan Sr. to Nani of the Blackpool Lounge Room and crooned,
Do not make yourself a fret. I am your laundry machine like always, am I not? Now, you just button your eyes on Nani, Mr. Hot of the Shot. Your big Danish head always thinks it is more full of things than the rest of the heads around here. But with it, you cannot even make roti that fails to taste like a foot. Watch tight, and presto changeo, Nani will do Mr. Bunnybug's best good lipstick trick.
The Esker approached the frockade, casually sang a few bars of something in her own language, something that felt like it was boxing their ears with unspeakable emotion. Something so full of grace and need that Des almost lurched forward to take the alien in his arms, like a crying child, before remembering all that nonsense about infrasounds and feeling very silly indeed. The seafoam green surface of the frockade sagged alarmingly, before lurching forward and absorbing the Roadrunner so quickly and completely that it pulled in Ort's and Decibel's cries of horror as well, leaving them slack-jawed and quiet. Ort St. Ultraviolet shrugged. There was nothing more to it, he supposed. Once they'd agreed to this madness, why object to the icing on top? He pulled down his threadbare Glampire Planet Tour t-shirt over the waist of his broad-striped linen pajama pants. No matter what the Bluebird said, he felt that he'd travelled in top style for the new jet set. Still no dad belly, even a cough and a groan past 40. It might not be much to be proud of, but it wasn't nothing either.
Ultraviolet sang his sole contribution as a lyricist, to their debut album much more softly than the Roadrunner, bracing involuntarily for the big ooze he knew was coming. No antibacterial gel could help him now. He stood on tiptoes in front of the Yuzosh portable toilet, shrugged, and belted one out for the cheap seats. "It's my own fault if I'm singing Chained to Venus. It's my own fault if I miss you every day. It's my own fault, 'cause I didn't read the terms of service, and I loved you anyway." The frockade seemed to accept his payment of one slightly wobbly a cappella X-hit single, and slurped the musician up without complaint. "He's fine." Decibel Jones puffed out a long, held breath. "He's fine. Totally alive." Everything was suddenly very quiet. The air on this weird, happy fun world tasted amazingly wholesome. It whipped up his blood like egg whites. "See you on the flip side," said Decibel Jones with a smart salute to no one in particular, and gave it his best song of his solo album, because it was a good album, damn it, no matter what Mira or Ort or his garbage man or the Guardian had said. And somebody ought to hear it, even if that somebody was a giant green toilet 7,000 light-years from Croydon. "I run on love and glitz and beer. I'm a futuro-grandiose lead machine. And up in lights, my name appears. I am Prozymandias, Queen of Queens." And then Jones was gone too. 24. Party for Everybody. Decibel Jones stepped alone out of the other end of a rock festival portable toilet and into a cocktail party already in progress. He recognized the room immediately. His shoulders relaxed instinctively, his jaw unclenched. He was at home here. Sometimes it felt as though Decibel had spent half his life in mid to high-end hotel suites and bars and reception lounges from London to Helsinki, to Rio, to Madison, Wisconsin. Junkets, conventions, corporate glad handing, meet and greets, charity gigs, binging on fried appetizers and drinks on the room after a day in the studio, in the club, at the arena, on the circuit. Whether he'd done it wearing scandalous glitter glad rags or incognito invisibility cloaks consisting of dark glasses and ratty shirts emblazoned with the faded tat of someone else's band, hardly made any difference. You were there to sell yourself, either way. But at least the nosh was free. All those hotel bars and ballrooms and suites flowed into one platonic hotel ballroom bar suite in Decibel's memory, and that platonic hotel space flowed out around him now. Low light, scuffed tables, bartender unhappy with his choices in life, but even less happy with anyone else's. Thin, hard, mean carpet in an indefinable yet ubiquitous shade of nothing, somewhere between turquoise and brown. Windows on the water in lieu of any real attempt at decor. Cheap paper napkins and thin black drink stirrers already dropped all over the floor. Chairs that somehow remained uncomfortable no matter how you shifted and scooched, paired with big, plush, mercenary loungers that sucked you down until any effort to talk to another person made you look like a child in a booster seat trying to talk to the big kids about the serious issues facing applesauce today. And there he found himself, in the sky bar of what, for all the world, appeared to be a mid-range Hilton. Banks of windows looked out on our mums, setting in gorgeous, joyful pastels over the lavender sea and gentle lights of Lemoo's notorious healing white light district far below. Decibel Jones stared at a broadsheet of dubious fonts stapled to a large sandwich board sign that read, "Welcome, Grand Pricks Contestants, BYOB. complete with the kind of deeply unfortunate typo you only find at events the logistics of which have been left up to embittered, unpaid interns bent on low-effort vengeance. The Hilton logo was crooked and looked far more like a drunken hieroglyph than a capital H. It pulsed a little. It bulged. Someone had put down their coffee cup on the bottom left corner and presumably just said, "Fuck it, no one will notice." Decibel remembered that typo and coffee stain combo. He and Mira had posed with one on the Glampire Planet tour. Ort had got his thumb on the lens. He was laughing so hard, which made it technically the last photo of all three of them ever taken. Decibel reached for a phone that wasn't there to take another picture, felt a bit stupid, and stepped onto the breach. The slightly dingy skybar was crowded with milling and swilling aliens of every shape, size, density, and attitude toward hygiene, all wearing large, friendly, "Hello, my name is" stickers on whatever they had that passed for a chest. There were Esker, Decibel saw gratefully, gingerly trying to sip from large margarita glasses of plankton, with slices of fruit hanging off the sugared rims, several different coloured straws, and festive umbrellas. Not an easy operation with a beak. A large cloud of multicoloured glitter floated over the blue fishbirds, moving and swooping and bulging in a way that was definitely intentful, not decorative. Beneath it, the Roadrunner was wearing a cloud of pearls and tears and shifting, illuminated words in a language beyond subjects, objects, or the vaguest concept of transparent prose. But there, Decibel's brief study of xenobiology failed him. The Roadrunner and E had tried, but it was all too much to remember now. Several small, dark creatures with huge eyes out of a goth toddler's colouring book peered up at the bar resentfully, a bar that was, unmistakably, filled to the brim with dirt like a denuded window planter. A throng of brutally pale, slender people who looked like basketball players rolled in antlers as painted by El Greco stood by the windows, trying to bend subtly at the knee, so as to not tower quite so much over a clique of silvery moths awkwardly clutching martinis. The tables were littered with crystal decanters, full of bubbling pink muck and weird, greenish stones. Five or six vast, globby golden tubes of wet flesh with bright veins of colour forking all over them, and a gaping hole full of tanning salon UV light where their faces should have been, were discussing something desperately important with a cluster of delicate clear balloons full of apricot gas, whose name badges all clearly said Ursula. And just then, somebody with a head like an exploded hippo burst out laughing, possibly laughing, at a joke, possibly a joke, told by what was clearly the rotting, deferred corpse of a Keshet. The ex-red panda turned mid-giggle and stared at him. Because it was a platonically perfect lobby-bar-suite ballroom, the walls behind the bar were covered in ill-advised mirrors, so you could see just how pompous you were coming off to everyone around you. Decibel Jones was filled with a powerful, primal urge to run and save himself from the shambling zombie raccoon corpse, lurching toward him with a huge smile on its rotting face. But, like Narcissus at the watering hole, he was too captivated by his own reflection to move. He hadn't seen himself at first. He hadn't known where to look. But he saw it all now. The Vorpret wore grey. He wore blue. And red. And green. And purple and black. And electric tangerine turquoise paisley. He was dressed as a punch-drunk, post-apocalyptic, go-go dancing Mr. Darcy. As Oscar Wilde. Finally stripped clean of even the thinnest vestige of English propriety, restraint, or subtlety. As Madame de Pompadour, on her way to interview for a CEO position she already had in the bag. And worst, or best, of all.
He could feel it all growing out of him, giving new meaning to the phrase skin tight, as it bloomed, budded, sprouted directly out of his flesh as naturally as hair or sweat. He winced a little, unused to the feeling of his skin really and actually crawling, still moving and adjusting with exquisite purpose as the useful goop of the yuz continued to merge with his mind and churn out its idea of fashion. Decibel seemed to be wearing Bowie's exact metallic mango-pistachio-coconut-striped trousers from the 1975 Ziggy Stardust shoot, buckled below the knee over chartreuse stockings, printed with all his worst reviews in tiny block letters. A loose, vaguely piratical, late-night neon-light shirt peeked out fetchingly beneath a savage underbust corset, made of something not unlike xenomorph skin as hunted, cut, and drenched in black glitter by Versace, and a cravat braided and stitched and hemmed from all the laciest underthings thrown at all the rowdiest stages he'd known. A square-cut patchwork Regency coat squeezed it all in, its tails exploding into a shower of every one of Nani's gorgeous silk scarves, trailing all the way to the floor. His lanky, dark hair was bejeweled and beribboned like a lost boy who'd recently discovered Neverland's underground club scene. He wore that lilac lipstick of his long-ago lounge room show and eyeliner fit for a raccoon in heat. He carried, to his surprised delight, a dandy's cane that looked suspiciously like a hacked-off mic stand. Lastly, because Des had always said Coco Chanel was full of insipidly scented shit, and, before he left the house every day, looked into the mirror and put one more thing on, a huge, plush, glowing cartoon coyote skin dripped over his shoulders, its cell-animated outline wriggling and jumping and popping like an old recording played too many times. Des had walked his share of red carpets in far more than his share of lurid, please-notice-me outfits. He'd heeded the bleats of tabloid reporters over and over, so instinctive and helpless and native to their kind. A cow goes moo, a sheep goes baa, a celebrity correspondent goes, who are you wearing? But if one of those pull-string see-and-say barnyard creatures had appeared out of the long light-years between here and home to ask him who he was wearing now, all he could have answered was, myself. Decibel Jones was dressed in the glorious, bombed-out rubble of his whole life. He was Raggedy Dandy, big as life and twice as hard. He never wanted to take it off.
"Brains!"
yelled the grey, oozing, hairless, pustulent Keshet as it lurched toward Decibel, dragging one munted leg behind it. He could see splintered ribs through its mouldering skin, its gums peeled back horribly from sharp, yellow teeth.
"Brains!"
"Darling," hummed a thick, sopping voice behind him. Not one voice, dozens, 100 maybe, in perfect, simultaneous, harmonious diction. It oozed expensive vowels, oligarchical consonants, the poshest of diphthongs. It dripped with sincerity and wisdom. It dripped its sincerity and wisdom all over the floor and got a bit on the cold cuts platter.
"Don't you just look marvelous?"
5 feet of velvety, undulating gold lame gumdrop waved one nub at him from beside the cheese plates. Its skin seemed to be made of Venetian glass, swirling with veins of gold and vivid color. It, he, she, z, they, had no face. Only a round, glowing, cilia-fringed hole where a face might think about setting up shop, and another one in the general belly area. The sticker on, plausibly, its chest read, "Hello, my name is Slecker 5. Decibel Jones
had just met his first Alunazar.
The talking gumdrop looked him over appraisingly and offered him a friendly martini glass full of something that looked like raw petroleum, with a disc of white lust-scented foam floating 3 inches off the rim. It picked up a cube of slightly sweaty Jarlsberg and delicately inserted the cheese into its stomach lumps, pulling the toothpick out clean with a satisfied grunt.
Not to say we're entirely sure what to make of all this business.
Slecker Five gestured vaguely at Dess's cravat and leaned forward confidentially.
It's not a completely emotionally balanced look, if you know what we mean. A bit of a mess, if we're to be honest with ourselves, and we rarely think we must be, considering the circumstances. Your ensemble lacks an underlying spiritual and emotional cohesion. The carpet of the id doesn't match the drapes of the superego, if you know what we mean. Doubtless some essential savagery afoot in there, no? And where is your friend, dear? It's a dangerous room to take on alone.
Brains!
Shouted the undeniably dead Keshet again. It picked up speed, stepping on the silky wings of a moth person who squealed ultrasonic indignation, causing half the room to turn and stare at the impending human-zombie collision. Decibel looked around for Ort, for the Roadrunner, for E, for a convenient social escape hatch. But the only things within reach were this dreadful conversation and a small model of Earth made out of water crackers and what he hoped was prosciutto. The Alunazar ignored the incoming zombie raccoon rocket. It focused its attention on Decibel like a weaponized Eton prefect.
We presume we need no introduction?
It trilled wetly. Something clicked in Decibel's back brain, and his autonomous system switched into a new mode. After-party, high-octane industrial flirt machine. Meet the fans, smile for the camera, charm the venue management, chuck anything that smacked of weakness or desperation or fear of the rapidly approaching future, secure the best possible bed for the night. The trick of it was to be ever so slightly too honest. No one warmed up to a perfectly professional musician, not even other musicians. They wanted you to be a little more real, a little more raw, a little more broken than they were, so they could feel magnanimous about booking you, buying your shit, promoting you, fucking you. So they could feel a little more human by osmosis. It was an equation Decibel had learned on day one of Life with the Zeros. Pain becomes playful, playful becomes pretty. Pretty becomes pleasure, pleasure becomes profit. Profit becomes safety. Another day not working at Mr. Five Star. Another day further from invisibility. He laughed, like the fate of his planet was a pickup line at a pub. Listen, mate, I was in a cab halfway to Adam Lambert's beach house with my tongue halfway down the venerable old chap's throat, and my brainstem halfway to totally obliterated by rum and imposter syndrome before I knew he used to be anybody at all. And all you've done is buy me a drink.
We are not your mate, friend. Nor do we understand what you mean by imposter syndrome. Is that a popular narcotic on your world?
Decibel Jones gave this a beautiful, ephemeral, jewel-like moment of genuine thought.
Just about the hottest one going, he admitted. And we all get high on our own supply. It's that thing where no matter what you do, or how high you rise in the world, you still think you're a wet smear of nothing, and everyone's just about to find out what a grubby little fraud you really are.
But we are not a fraud. We don't get it.
Decibel tried again.
You know, sometimes, even though everything is going your way, and you're doing the whole type A overachiever shimmy, you still can't quite believe you're deserving of, well, anything. Love, Success, happiness, stability.
But we achieved.
Jones started to sweat. It was like trying to explain what your most essential soul looked like to an atheist.
It feels like you're only doing a magic trick.
See, with a bunny and a bunch of cellophane flowers and a hat. And everyone's fooled, but really, really, you're the empty hat. You're not even the stupid bunny. You're not even the fucking cello flowers. You're nobody. And sooner or later, your best abracadabras aren't going to work anymore.
Is that Keshet talking to me, do you think?
This is an unpleasant exchange. We always